Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
If it's Thursday, the rules of political history may not apply, at least not right now. Untested candidates, unpredictable turnout, the Trump factor, all of it shaking up this midterm environment. What we know, what we don't, and what it all could mean for November. Plus, more documents breaking down a Florida judge's decision handed down just a few minutes ago that will likely unseal some parts of that key Mar-a-Lago search document. But we're not going to get it today. We'll explain. And with the crisis-level teacher shortage facing schools across the country, some districts are going to some extreme measures to fill this gap, including cutting down on the number of days in school. Hello, happy Thursday, and welcome to Meet the Press. Now I'm Chuck Todd. Folks, we are obviously politically living in some very unusual times. You don't need me to tell you that. We all live it. And it is true, though, for so many reasons, not the least of which is the court hearing today in Florida about last week's unprecedented FBI search of a former president's home. This is not your normal midterm election cycle. The era of Trump is an outlier, and that includes these upcoming midterm elections. If you look at the measurements that have typically defined midterm elections, Republicans should be headed toward some big gains this November. And by the way, it still may end up that way. President Biden's approval rating sits in the high 30s or low 40s, has ticked up a little bit recently. Vast majority of the country says we're headed in the wrong direction. Some 3 out of 4 Americans believe this in most polling. Republicans have a minor lead in the generic ballot, which historically is dangerous territory for Democrats. But again, it doesn't matter what history says right now these days, because former President Trump's presence has inserted wild cards everywhere you look this season. And right now, the outlook for Democrats in these midterms is surprisingly bullish, considering those other metrics I just showed you, especially when it comes to the fight for control of the Senate. When you look at the Senate map, everything right now seems to be tilting in the Democrats' favor. Even Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell today downplayed expectations for taking back control of the Senate. Take a listen.
Yeah, I think there's probably a greater likelihood the House flips than the Senate. Senate races are just different. They're statewide. Candidate quality has a lot to do with the outcome.
One thing about Mitch McConnell, everything he says is intentional and carefully worded. Candidate quality. You heard it there from Mitch McConnell. In some key states, Republicans have ended up with relatively weak nominees, many emerging from bruising, expensive primaries, where they were propped up by former President Trump. Take Pennsylvania, which is a seat that Democrats are hoping to pick up as Republican Pat Toomey retires. Trump-backed candidate Republican Mehmet Oz is trailing his Democratic opponent John Fetterman by double digits in one recent poll. Our friends at the Cook Political Report moved that race from toss-up to lean Democratic this morning. And if Pennsylvania is off the board, that means Republicans need to flip at least 2 states held by Democrats right now to win the Senate. I'm going to get into more of how that Senate math shakes out in just a second. But let's talk about another wild card right now. That's turnout. Recent primaries in Kansas, Wyoming, and Alaska, they point to some huge numbers of people, potentially record numbers of people coming out to vote in November, left and right. And the bigger the turnout, the more uncertainty that gets introduced. Trust me, every political consultant knows how to handle and has an idea of where things are headed in normal turnout election environments. But when that turnout starts going up, all bets are off. Then there's the issue of abortion. That's greatly increased voter enthusiasm, particularly on the left. But the ultimate wild card is Trump himself. Unlike any cycle we've seen in the past, a losing presidential candidate has remained on the national stage, largely turning these races from a referendum on the president's first term to a choice between the Biden vision and the Trump vision. So while all signs historically would point to a thumping for Democrats or a shellacking, pick your adjective, I'm here to argue that the old rules of politics do not apply right now. We are living in an outlier era that began on June 11th, 2015. So joining me now to break down where our Senate map stands these days is our battleground expert when it comes to Senate races, Jessica Taylor, obviously of our friends at the Cook Political Report. So here's where we're defining the large sort of competitive Senate battleground. Any issues here? Are we missing any states here? We're pretty generous here with our 14.
Yeah, you've got some on there that I think are Republicans are feeling a little better about, like Missouri, but then having to worry about a little bit more in Ohio.
Let me ask you this. Let's do one here that feels the same. Washington, Democrats are favored. Iowa, Republicans are favored. But they both seem to be, like, kind of in competitive territory.
I mean, you do have Chuck Grassley's numbers in Iowa lower than where he usually has been.
Yeah.
That may just be the fact that he's been there forever.
Yeah.
He's going to be in his 90s if he finishes his term. So, new blood. But I think I still find it hard-pressed that
Iowa,
they're going to vote for a Democrat.
Yeah, it's still a light red state these days. Missouri, it feels like they escaped the Greitens issue. Yes, there's a third candidate in there. We'll see. How do you, Utah, you moved to likely Republican. Evan McMullen has told me he is not going to be with either party if he wins. So where do you put it in our little game here?
I mean, it's hard to tell. Like, that's what he says. But, like, that's very hard to do when you come to Washington. If you want clout, if you want influence. But we also have seen, you know, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, by being in the middle, even with a party, they've increased their, likelihood, their clout.
Right. Let's go to one more likely here. Colorado. This is one you moved today. Sitting in likely, or are you going to go to lean, you think, at some point?
No, we've moved it to lean.
You've moved it to lean.
Yes.
And all on candidate quality on the positive side for Republicans.
Right. Republicans won here. Joe O'Day, a construction company owner, won this primary. If they had Joe O'Days in places like Pennsylvania, Arizona, Ohio, I think the map would be looking a lot better for Republicans. Colorado is still a hard state, but Michael Bennett has always fallen just short of getting a majority. Biden and Trump's numbers are very low in that state. But, you know, O'Day is able to distance himself from Trump in a way.
And you'd classify him, most voters would classify him as sort of pro-choice on abortion.
He is. He's somewhere in the middle. But he doesn't, you know, the way we've seen candidates in much more competitive states say no exceptions, no rape and incest exceptions. But he is not where that is.
All right. Now we're getting down to the nine most competitive that are on the board right now. Let's start with the two Republican seats that we know will be in the battleground the whole time, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. Wisconsin, you have not moved yet, so we will leave it there. Pennsylvania, you went ahead and moved it.
We did.
Why'd you do it?
We have just consistently seen that Fetterman has an edge outside of the margin of error. But when you drill down into those crosstabs, Dr. Oz, well-known in the state, survived a bruising primary, but didn't really do anything to rehabilitate his image afterwards.
Right.
He took a vacation to Ireland. His approval numbers across the state they're lower than Biden's in some instances. And he's got to do something to sort of rehabilitate his image, you know, to Fetterman, who's trying to be a populist and, you know, shopping for crudité at Wegmans is not the way to do it.
And you don't say crudité. To a Democrat, Manella Barnes that's a large lead, but we've also seen Ron Johnson come back before.
It has. Like, I feel like that poll is an outlier. No Republican or Democrat I talked to believes at this point that the Democrat is up by 7 points. In fact, I think Democrats were a little worried about Barnes as a candidate because he has a lot of very progressive policies.
Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, they feel like the same races to me.
They are. I think North Carolina is the more competitive. They're all in our lean Republican column.
So you're going to put them all in lean Republican for now. But of the one that you expect to move to toss up.
I could see North Carolina moving first.
Before either Florida, Ohio, even though Ryan and Deming seem to be fundraising juggernauts.
They are. Florida, as you well know, is a very expensive state. Republicans, it's just, you can get to 47 as a Democrat, but getting those last 3 points is just Herculean. And in Ohio, the alarm bells are coming, but the cavalry's coming too. J.D. Vance has been behind. Another poll showed him up. $28 million McConnell's super PAC is coming in there.
All right. So we're down to our final five. One party, if they win three of the five, they hold the Senate right now. Arizona, which way?
I would tilt it toward Democrats at
all
this
right.
point.
Georgia, which way?
That's hard. That's maybe one of the closest, maybe to Democrats right now.
I was just going to say, show me a poll that has Walker ahead. It doesn't exist, right?
If he gets over the finish line, it may be because Brian Kemp drags him over the finish line.
I keep thinking New Hampshire is going to be a lot closer than other people think, but boy, the Republicans are trying to make it very difficult.
Yeah, we still have this one rated lame Democrat because of the primary is not until next month. If it is Don Baldock, who is leading the primary polls right now, I think this race becomes really much easier for Hassan. Her numbers aren't great, but if it's Chuck Morris, the Senate president, I think this becomes a competitive race.
So we just got the Democrats to 50 without Nevada or Wisconsin.
Yep.
That's the point here, is the Republicans are in a bit more of a challenge than they had 6 months ago, right?
Yeah. 50-50, it stays the same. I've talked with strategists that actually believe this could be a wash. You started with the 50-50 Senate, hundreds of millions of dollars are spent, you end with the 50-50 Senate.
Would you classify Nevada as the closest in the country?
I think it is, and I think right behind Pennsylvania, I think it's the most likely to flip. That is just a really hard state for Democrats in a midterm year. Catherine Cortez Masto, half of the state turns over. It's such a transient state. So I think Nevada's hard. And like you said, in Wisconsin, Ron Johnson has come from behind.
We have all been snake bit by Wisconsin before. But I think we just told the story that your wonderful publication told today. Jessica Taylor, fine work. I can't wait to do this more.
Anytime.
Thank you. Got a great panel to chew on all of this. Brad Todd, Republican strategist who eats, sleeps, and drinks Senate races. Xochitl Hinojosa, former Democratic strategist, has done her share of this. And Susan Page, of course, has been a journalist friend and political compadre, I guess is the way to do it. Bureau chief at USA Today. How do you describe this midterm election to folks? Is it in that, because it doesn't seem ordinary.
It's not ordinary. And you know what? It doesn't look like a wave election. And that's what we thought some months ago that we were looking at with the inflation numbers and President Biden's lack of popularity. But it doesn't feel that way now in either the House or the Senate, which makes it possible for Mitch McConnell to be right when he talks about candidate quality, which is a phrase I'm sure he is using to target Trump's role in these Senate races.
You know, in the pre-Trump era, Brad, there was a lot of happy talk in August, and then the reality in a midterm year, September would come, and you're like, oh, yeah, that's where we're headed. Chances that happens this time?
Very high. You know, the midterm elections are about gas pedal or brake pedal on the current president. The current president, as you mentioned, his approval ratings are in the high 30s in every Senate state, just like they are nationwide. And so you're asking Democratic candidates to get one in six people who have a negative view of the president or don't have a positive view. It's something that's really hard. You know, in Colorado in 2020, I worked for Cory Gardner, who was a popular incumbent, ran a great campaign, couldn't be a better campaigner. Donald Trump's rating in the Colorado that year was 42. Cory got 44. And so a great candidate running a great campaign ran 2 points ahead of his president's approval rating. That's the kind of reality Democrats are going to face this fall.
I would be concurring with everything Brad said in a pre-Trump environment. I'm not sure this time, Xochitl, but what say you?
Well, I would say it is a very, very tough environment for Democrats. But just as we saw on the map right now, Democrats have more options to 50 than Republicans do. And I would have said 2 months ago, I don't know if we're going to hold on to the Senate. I think Democrats, like Mitch McConnell, I never agree with Mitch McConnell, but what I will say, it's more likely that Republicans flip the House and take hold, you know, and Democrats take hold and keep hold of the Senate than we have before. And it's because of recruitment failures. It's because of untested candidates. It is Republicans have done this to themselves. And on Joe Biden's approval rating, one thing I'd point out is all of these Senate candidates have been tested in these states. A lot of the seats that we are protecting, they, in very few instances are, underwater. But for the most part, these Democratic Senate candidates are strong candidates compared to what Republicans have this time.
You know, the other thing, it's possible that at the end of the day, we'll be able to say that Donald Trump cost Republicans control of the Senate twice. Because in 2018, his actions were no favor in those Georgia Senate elections that gave this 50-50 majority to the Democrats.
It's always been a question. Will that matter to Republicans who support Donald Trump if he costs them the Senate a second time?
Well, I think voters tend to blame the candidates that lose the election for losing the
election. They're not going to blame Trump for Dr. Oz? They're not going to blame Trump for Herschel Walker?
I think you're asking voters to play political handicapper.
Yeah, you may be right.
When they pick between the candidates, they had their own choices.
Look, you've done some work for Rick Scott. He's the NRSC chair. What these money moves that we've seen, it certainly looks like this is a committee that's realizing, well, we got to make the best with the batch of candidates that we have, not the ones that we want.
Well, the job is to get to 51. period. And you do that with money you reserve in a lot of places. You move your money to your best bets as you get closer to the election. But that's one thing I would like to say that Republicans, if there's one reason Republicans don't win the majority this year, it's because Republican donors are not as fired up as Democratic donors. And Republicans have a great chance to get to 51. They have a great chance to achieve or all the things Republicans want, or at least to block the things that Democrats want. But it's going to mean Republican donors have to step up in these last 2 months.
So what's your explanation why donors aren't stepping up on the right?
I think that, first off, Republican donors are bifurcated from Republican voters in a lot of ways right now. A lot of Republican donors are not really crazy about President Trump. The low donors who love President Trump better than anyone, they kind of like President Trump more than they like other
people. And they only give to Trump, right?
They only give to Trump. So you have one group of donors who doesn't want to give to President Trump and doesn't want him to be influential in the process. You have another group of donors who only wants to give when he's on the ballot. But you don't get to be picky in politics. It's a team sport. And if you want your taxes to go up, then you need to sit on the sidelines. If you want your taxes to go down, you need to rally for Republican Senate candidates. It's really simple.
So, Xochitl, there does appear to be an opportunity that Democrats can turn this into a choice election, right? This is always the thing. Referendum, no incumbent wants to be the referendum.
Absolutely.
Does that mean keeping Biden off the trail?
I think Biden still hits the trail. He won many of these states. I think they will utilize him at the end.
How do you do it? How do you do it without create? Because you don't, you know, when Trump shows up, if Trump's stumping in October, it fires up his sort of casual voters. But we know it fires up the left, too. Do you worry about that with Biden?
I don't worry about it. I think there are very specific places where Biden can be utilized. I think that if he can go out there and talk about how he has delivered for people, how he has solved their problems, also go into minority communities. You have places like Georgia where there is a large black community where I think that he can fire up voters. There's places in Nevada where we definitely need some firing up of Latino voters. And I think that he can go in there and make the case in certain instances and still come out on top. On the money piece, I just want to address this. I actually think spending is low on both sides. I think raising for specific candidates can raise a lot of money. You see Mark Kelly, you see Raphael Warnock, others raise money. I would say the Democratic ecosystem as a whole and outside spending is not where we have seen in previous years. And that is something that worries me, just because I'm worried that Democrats are going to take this election for granted and not necessarily spend to turn out our voters the way we need to.
There does seem to be a lot of money spent on trying to raise more money.
Yeah, as always, right? Yeah. Who always does well in elections?
Yeah.
It's the consultants, no offense.
Well, but you also have inflation that's impacted fundraising for sure, especially on the low donor end. You know, if you're paying twice as much for gas, you can't send $50 to your favorite candidate. I will tell you that we'd spend whatever money we have to get Joe Biden a suite at the Ritz-Carlton in Atlanta if he would go there the rest of the campaign.
You know, I wonder, though, it's true that the presidential approval metric is the one that's the most reliable in midterms. And as you say, it's hard for for candidates in his or her party to get very much distance between them. But that's not been true in the recent polls. And I wonder if the nature of Biden's approval disapproval rating is different than it is certainly from Trump. Because with Trump, you love him or you hate him. And with Biden, maybe you approve, maybe you disapprove. But it lacks that toxic factor that I think makes it matter most.
I think the trick with Joe Biden is it's not a hate thing, much like we saw in 2010 with Obama. Obama's ratings were above water in
personally.
The 2020
people liked
election,
him, right? Didn't agree.
But they
with
felt them. Like they felt like you needed a slight course correction, and so that's why they shifted it. Voters are genuinely pretty skeptical of one party controlling Washington. The swing voters are in the middle. They don't want that. They don't feel safe that way. And I think that's still the impulse.
Well, this is what's interesting, and I'm trying to remember if I made the staff put this in here or not. But I noticed Sherry Beasley's ad in North Carolina attacks Washington. Okay. I'm seeing, you know, it's even always more amusing to me when it's like an incumbent that does it. But I'm seeing a lot of House Democrats who are incumbents beating up Washington. It, you know, that does sort of reinforce Brad's point that he thinks at some point this does tip back into the brake pedal, gas pedal metaphor that he's pushing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that all of these Senate candidates, especially on the Democratic side, they have their own messages. People know them in their states. They, you know, blaming Washington makes a lot of sense. And that is a very good point on President Biden's approval rating. And I will say there was actually some course correction when it came to the White House and their messaging and their accomplishments. You know, there has been a course correction with this president that I think will impact his approval rating, where I don't think that he will be a burden as much.
I keep coming back to this. In the last 2 weeks, who do we see more on the trail, Susan? Trump or Biden?
the last 2 weeks before the campaign.
Yeah.
Try to keep Donald Trump off the campaign trail.
Right.
The biggest effort is going to be
good luck,
to
Rick
keep
Scott.
Him, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think he's going to be able to do it.
The biggest to keep him from actually announcing he's running again for president before the midterm is over. Because if you want the referendum. Democrats would love to have the referendum be on Trump, and Republicans would love to have this referendum be on Biden.
Can you convince him to just campaign in Alaska?
You can't convince Donald Trump of anything. But we've never had an election about a former president in a midterm. It's never happened. Elections are about the current president or the future. And so this will be the first time ever, if that's the case. And by the way, Republicans also have a problem in the last midterm that people who liked Donald Trump didn't show up. Because he wasn't on the ballot.
This is why high turnout to me is unpredictable.
There is a two-edged sword. I mean, both parties have low propensity voters now. That was not the case 10 years ago. 10 years ago, they were mostly Democratic.
You look at Wyoming and Kansas. One benefit of the left, one benefit of the right. Turnout was huge.
Absolutely.
So if a bunch of low propensity voters come out, you know,
good for that.
Yes.
Like high turnout.
We'll just sit there and watch and show you what happened rather than predict.
That's what people are thinking. And we find that out.
Freaks them out, though, because they got to know the result before.
Yeah.
Anyway, Susan Sochi and Brad. It's just fun to just do some races. So thank you. We're going to have a lot more midterm analysis on Tuesday's Meet the Press Election Night special. Don't miss it right here at 9 p.m. Eastern, NBC News Now, our final primary night special before we start getting focused on the general. Coming up, a judge moves to partially unseal the affidavit that was at the heart of the decision to execute a search warrant on Mar-a-Lago, giving the government 1 week to decide what they want redacted from this affidavit. What does it mean for the former president's legal drama? We'll discuss that next. Plus, after a stunning admission from the CDC director that the agency fell short during COVID, the agency wants to make some major changes as the country faces new concerns about monkeypox and polio. You're watching Meet the Press Now.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Welcome back. A judge in Florida this afternoon indicated he would unseal some of the affidavit at the heart of the search warrant behind the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago last week. The judge gave the Department of Justice 1 week to make redactions to the document, or at least redactions that they would like to have, which the government wants to keep entirely sealed, and that he would reevaluate once he'd seen a redacted version. Now, the affidavit in question is the document federal investigators used to justify the execution of a search warrant for the former president's Florida home. The judge who heard arguments today is the same one who approved the original search warrant last week. Now, the Department of Justice asked the court to keep the affidavit completely sealed, saying it was necessary to protect witnesses and their ongoing investigation. President Trump and his supporters have called for the immediate release of the affidavit, accusing the Justice Department and FBI of government overreach. The news media, including us here at NBC News, filed suit asking the Department of Justice and the court for the document to be made public because of what we argue is an immense amount of interest surrounding the investigation and, frankly, a lot of political conspiracy circulating that having the facts out could perhaps curtail. Our senior national political reporter, Mark Caputo, is outside of the courthouse in West Palm Beach and on deadline for me, so I got to get to him fast. Ken Delanian, our NBC News Justice Intelligence correspondent, is here with me on set. And Carol Lamb is our NBC News legal analyst and former U.S. attorney. Mark, you were in the courtroom. I can tell you this. A lot of veterans of covering the Justice Department are surprised where the judge came down. Give us a little sense of why the reasoning he gave of why he was leaning towards opening it.
Well, the government admitted in court, Jay Bratt, who's the DOJ's top national security official, that, look, this is an unprecedented case. There's unique interest in here. This is history, and it's important. Everyone agreed on that fact, including the judge. He had read, as he said, the search warrant affidavit ahead of time. He said he had an idea of what he might redact. He wanted to see what the government would do. So in the end, if you're, I guess if you're just kind of paying attention to this, the reality is you can't ignore the fact that this is one of the most, this is probably the most important criminal case that we've seen in politics in the modern era, if not ever. It seems like everyone's admitting that. The question is, to what degree do we want what facts disclosed to the public and when?
Did the arguments that Justice was making, what was their main reasoning for why they believe this shouldn't be made public?
I mean, it sounded like if you didn't know there was a former president whose home was searched, you would think that this was a mafia case. They were talking about threats to witnesses, investigative techniques they didn't want out there, sensitive information they didn't want released. The Jay Bratt, the national security official with DOJ, had mentioned the recent case of the FBI agents whose addresses or identities were doxxed in right-wing media. And he mentioned there are, quote, amateur sleuths out there on the internet who can find out information about these other witnesses, and it could chill other witnesses from coming forward. So their main argument was like, look, if you release this, a direct quote he said, is this is a roadmap to the investigation. And he said it is early in the investigation currently, so there's a lot more time to spend, a lot more investigating to be done.
Mark Caputo, our eyewitness in the courtroom for us today. Mark, I know you're crashing on a deadline. I'll let you go. Ken Delaney, and you cover that building. You've covered it for quite a long time. It's not a surprise that Justice doesn't want to reveal. They never, whether it's the intel community, sources admit, there's always an excuse. There's always a reason the government wants to keep a secret here. What do you expect? You know, do you expect them to essentially say, okay, here's what we want to redact, and then take a black magic marker and essentially color the entire piece of paper?
Well, first of all, I'm stunned that the judge is even agreeing to do this. The case law is against it, as our experts have said. But I do still think it will be heavily redacted. But this is the guy who signed the warrant. He knows what's in it. So he must think there's something the public can learn here, beyond just the background of the FBI agent who filled out the affidavit. But everything that Mark just described, the sources and methods, the names of witnesses and agents, that has to be redacted. I don't see any circumstance under which that is released. And also, anything related to grand jury material is secret by law.
Right.
So if there were subpoenas that went down to Mar-a-Lago, that has to be redacted.
But isn't it fair? So the parts, though, then that we could end up seeing is when he says it's a roadmap to the investigation, what parts of it then do you expect us that we might see?
Perhaps a broad kind of an assertion of what this case is about. And we now think we know that it's about more than just they wanted to get their documents back, because otherwise they wouldn't be fighting so hard to keep this secret.
Right.
And they've said this is an ongoing investigation involving these three statutes that go to the mishandling of government records.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to learn a little bit more about what they think may have happened here.
Carol Lam, are you as surprised as Ken Delaney?
I guess I'm surprised to an extent that it would have been easy and it would have been accepted if this judge had said, we're not even going to have a hearing. This is an ongoing investigation that's been represented to me by the Department of Justice. So I'm just going to exercise my discretion here and say, we're not having a hearing and you can appeal me if you want, media. But given that he granted the hearing, I did begin to suspect that he was going to start looking at whether redactions were a possibility. Now, remember that the Justice Department represented in their papers that they've already gone through this exercise. They already tried to see what the document would look like if they redacted everything that was confidential in their view, and they said the result would be incoherent to a reader. So they've already gone through this exercise, which is why I think they didn't ask for more time, because they've already made the decision that not much can be exposed. Having done a lot of search warrants, especially white collar search warrants, I tried to put myself in the position of these prosecutors in what could possibly be disclosed. I don't think that they would even want to disclose the scope of the potential case, because that's just more than they would want to hand out at this time. They haven't made that decision. They don't know where the evidence is going to lead them down the road. What they would probably be willing to expose are the visits that they made to Mar-a-Lago in the past, because that's already been in the public domain. There are background things that you say in a search warrant. You might say, in my experience, as an FBI agent. I know the documents are often kept in this form, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But these are really not going to tell you anything about the current investigation. So I think the department's going to come in very conservative. The judge will make his decision about whether he agrees or disagrees with the department. But remember, he was an assistant U.S. attorney for 11 years, and he worked for the Justice Department.
Is this appealable?
Yes, it is absolutely appealable. Okay. It is appealable to the district court, then the appellate court, then, if necessary, the Supreme Court. So if the Justice Department is not satisfied with the judge's decision, right, no one's going to see anything for a while.
Is your sense, Ken, that they would be willing to file an appeal if they didn't like where this was headed by this judge?
Absolutely. There's such a sensitivity right now about exposing the names of FBI agents, for example. Right. You know, two were leaked when the warrant was
some news organization posted, right?
Yes,
they got the version leaked from another source, not the government.
And there have been threats against those particular agents, and now the Trump folks are talking about putting out the surveillance video of the search, mm-hmm, and the Justice Department has formally asked news organizations, if they do that, please blur out the faces of FBI agents.
Carol, big picture here. To me, the most important news story, that the most important development over the last 48 hours was that justice was fighting this. I mean, doesn't that tell you that this is not about just getting some classified documents back into the hands of the U.S. government?
Chuck, I've never thought that this was only about getting the documents back. I don't think that the department would use these techniques if it was just about getting the documents back, because you're supposed to use search warrants in furtherance of a criminal investigation. And if there are classified or even sensitive documents out there, and they execute a search warrant, yeah, and for that matter, grand jury subpoenas, which we've now been told took place, there has to be a good faith belief that somebody may be criminally liable here. So none of that is surprising to me, but I have a lot of concern, yeah, about what's going to happen in the future regarding search warrants.
Ken, does Trump's lawyers get to see the affidavit?
They're going to get to see whatever we see.
Yeah,
they're,
that's why they want it released. They want to see the whole thing. That's why it's easy for them to say, hey, release the whole thing, because they want to know the scope of the investigation.
Strategically, that helps them. But yeah, they didn't ask for the release in court. And I was wondering whether that's because it may help them strategically, but it could be terrible for the president as a public relations matter.
Interesting. Ken Delaney and Carol Lamb, before that, Mark Caputo, who was on site for us. Thank you all. I think I understand this better, which is the point of the segment. So, up next, the CDC director, Rochelle Walensky, is calling for sweeping agency-wide changes as the U.S. responds to multiple ongoing virus outbreaks. Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb will be here next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky is admitting that the agency must make some drastic changes to better respond to public health emergencies. As we reported here yesterday in an email to CDC employees, Walensky outlined some of those changes, including an overhaul of how the agency analyzes and shares data and how the CDC quickly communicates information to the public. The push for accountability comes as the nation is dealing with multiple public health challenges right now. The extremely transmissible BA5 subvariant continues to be the dominant COVID strain in the United States. Some new boosters are being developed to target the strain, and that's expected to be available in the fall. The U.S. also has seen an outbreak of monkeypox, with cases now numbering more than 13,000. And then there's polio, which has been identified in New York City wastewater after a case was reported in Rockland County last month. So joining me now, sort of get the lay of the land here of our public health area, is Dr. Scott Gottlieb. He's a former FDA commissioner himself, a CNBC contributor, and easily one of our country's foremost experts on public health. Dr. Gottlieb, it's good to see you, sir.
Thanks a lot.
So let's start with, it in some ways, Director Walensky's statement and email was sort of a bit of like, okay, that's exactly what you would expect. You would hope an after-action report of sorts would indicate. Based on what you've read of the email and what she's talking about, is she on the right track?
I think she is. I think the CDC director was pretty unflinching in her analysis of what the systemic problems have been at CDC, not just in the setting of the COVID pandemic, and the monkeypox outbreak, but going back to Ebola and Zika, even seasonal flu, where the agency has suffered systemic problems trying to gather data, make it available to the public, speak directly to the public, put out guidance that's actionable, that's bottom line, that businesses and consumers can interpret. The agency's long suffered from the fact that it has a very academic culture. They are accustomed to trying to collect information, put out analysis and published articles, and not speak directly to consumers in actionable ways. And I think she was pretty unflinching in her analysis of that, and, you know, is on a path to trying to put in place some reforms that will start to address it.
You know, it's always odd to me, Dr. Gottlieb, that we never, that the CDC director was never the one front and center at the beginning of this pandemic, and whether it was the current CDC director or the previous one, that it was sort of, that it was coming from NIH. You bring up the academic. Shouldn't NIH be the sort of more academic environment and CDC be the more public health emergency agency? No?
Yeah, look, parts of CDC are action-oriented. They're operationally driven. But by and large, that organization has a very academic culture where they're accustomed to collecting information and doing very long-dated analytical work and not putting out real-time information that can inform current decisions and inform policymakers. The decision in terms of whether or not the CDC is speaking to these issues on a daily basis or someone else in the administration was doing that, that's ultimately a decision made by the White House. If you remember during the Ebola outbreak, the Obama administration had Besser, the CDC director, right, really run point on that and be the spokesperson. During the Trump administration, the CDC director didn't speak to the COVID epidemic. And in this administration, they've had other people running point for them in terms of the communication. That's really a decision by the White House.
Is there any of this in what she announced at CDC that her hands are going to be tied a little bit because of HHS?
Well, ultimately, she's going to need support of HHS, but I think the real challenge is going to be that in order to fundamentally reform that organization, you're going to need help from Congress. Ultimately, with certain aspects of what they do when it comes to their core disease control mission and really their national security mission, they need new authorities and new resources. I think in terms of getting a bargain from Congress, what they ought to be thinking about is trying to narrow the scope of the CDC's mission, trying to give to sister agencies components of what CDC currently does that other agencies may be able to do just as well, if not better. For example, post-market vaccine adverse event reporting. Some of the tobacco work can both be handled by FDA. Some of the disease prevention research can be handled by NIH. And then go to Congress and say, look, we want to focus on the disease control mission, but to do that well, we're going to need some new resources and new authorities. I think the only way that CDC is going to get those new resources and authorities from Congress is in some kind of bargain like that where they more tightly focus the mission of that organization.
Is the current monkeypox outbreak sort of another exhibit to say, hey, this is how, boy, we were a little slow here, and yeah, this is another example of CDC being a little bit on their back foot.
Well, CDC and HHS, I think we've suffered from the fact that we've done things very sequentially in the setting of this outbreak rather than in parallel. For example, the issues around the vaccine supply, they could have made some decisions early on to start finishing some of that vaccine. They had 11.5 million doses in frozen bulk product that they could have started finishing right away while they worked with the manufacturer to scale up manufacturing of new stock. Those things were done very sequentially, and so we didn't have enough supply early in the setting of the outbreak really to address the public health challenge. So I think it's some of the same mistakes that are being made over again, but these really go back a decade. I think the agency's been operating this way for a very long time.
Let me ask you on COVID, should we take any positive feelings away, the fact that there hasn't been a new variant pop up in a while?
Well, I think it's too early to really draw conclusions, but there is a presumption that at some point the future mutations are going to continue to happen within one lineage. And it may be the fact that this Omicron lineage is the dominant lineage now, and then future mutations that do occur are going to continue to happen within this lineage. And if that's the case, then a lot of the immunity that we've built up from past variants of Omicron should provide sufficient cross immunity that you won't see this spread as aggressively as you've seen with these new variants when they've emerged. So I think that you could take some comfort in that fact that we haven't seen a new variant emerge, right, although it's still early. These new variants seem to emerge on a sort of a 2 to 3 month timeline. So we're probably due for one within the next month if it's going to emerge.
And I hope my question didn't just jinx us there, right? It's like watching a football game and the announcer says the field goal kicker hasn't missed one in so long. Very quickly on polio. This finding in the wastewater, this should be containable. How concerned are you, though, with vaccine hesitancy that if we do try to get some folks revaccinated here, we may have a problem.
Well, it should be containable, but if you look at that county where it seems to be spreading, I think at this point there is community transmission. That seems to be the message coming out of the CDC and public health officials in New York. That community only has about, Rockland County only has about a 60% vaccination rate, and some parts of that county are as low as 37%. So we're going to have to do a lot better than that if we're going to control the spread of this. And vaccination rates have fallen all across the country. I think a lot of the criticism of COVID vaccinations spilled over into people's willingness to take other vaccines.
Yeah, hopefully it doesn't cause other nearly eradicated diseases to start popping up as well. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, good to have you on. Thanks for sharing your perspective with us.
Thanks a lot.
After the break, a Democratic Senate candidate makes a rare stop in one of the key counties we've been watching all fall. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. When we picked Anson County, North Carolina, as one of the places we want to watch this year with our NBC County to County project, it was in part a measure of whether the Democratic Party was figuring out how to engage and turn out the rural black vote. It's something that they had not done very well the last couple of cycles. Its population didn't turn out for Joe Biden 2020, didn't turn out for Hillary Clinton 2016, did turn out for Barack Obama in 2008, and he carried North Carolina. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, the North Carolina Senate race is one we're keeping an eye on in November. And turnout is everything. Democratic Senate candidate Sherry Beasley will be facing off against Trump-backed Republican Congressman Ted Budd in the general. It's probably the most competitive under-the-radar race going on right now because there's no extra celebrity involved these days. And after an incredibly narrow loss in 2020 in her race for Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court, yes, North Carolina is one of those states that elects judges, Beasley has been adopting what she calls a campaign everywhere approach, working to spend as much time in some rural counties as well as urban areas. One of the rural areas that Beasley went recently was Anson County, and that's where our own Antonia Hilton caught up with her, speaking with the candidate and some voters.
Do politicians come here that often?
No. No. We usually see them in Mecklenburg County.
What do you think is at stake right now?
Well, again, being a rural county, just getting people out to vote.
With less than 3 months until the election, Beasley is betting on rural voters. She needs them, and they need someone who won't forget them once in Washington.
It felt good here today, right? It felt good here in Anson County. It felt good in Richmond County. And no one should feel discounted. No one should feel a sense of disengagement.
The real test will be not just the candidate showing up. We'll find Antonia Hilton's going to be finding out whether you actually see the campaigns engage when the candidates are not there. You can see more of Antonia Hilton's county to county reporting on meetthepress.com. Antonia is also working with Ted Budd's campaign to spend a day with him on the trail. And we will bring some of that to you in the coming weeks. After the break, states are scrambling to find staffing amid this national teacher shortage. I'm going to talk to two reporters from two different places that are feeling the pressure about how schools in their states are trying to convince teachers to stay in school. Please don't retire. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. Unless you live in the Northeast, many students are already back in the classroom now in many other parts of the country, but plenty of school districts are still struggling to recruit and hire the teachers and staff they need. The Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates about 300,000 public school teachers and staff left the profession between February 2020, start of the COVID pandemic, and May of 2022. Governors and superintendents across the country are using all sorts of means to try to address the teacher shortage. In Arizona, Governor Ducey signed a bill last month that allows college students to take teaching jobs while they complete their degree. In New Jersey, the state legislature passed a bill that would eliminate a testing requirement for new teachers, though Governor Murphy has yet to sign this bill. Other states are hoping to retain their teachers by simply increasing salaries by thousands of dollars, lowering qualifications. And then the most extreme cases are contemplating shortening the school week. But many of these proposals are only short-term fixes at best, and there is little to signal that this teacher shortage will ease anytime soon. The biggest problem, of course, is many college students are not majoring in education, so the actual pool of new teachers continues to shrink. I'm joined now by two people who have been covering this issue extensively in different parts of the country. Trisha Powell Crane is a reporter for the Alabama Education Lab at AL.com, and Brian Lopez is a public education reporter at the Texas Tribune. So, look, let me start with you in Alabama there, and just walk me through. I mean, I have some family in Northwest Florida. I know the situation there. I imagine it is similar. But it's not just teachers. It's across the board in Alabama, isn't it?
It is. I think, you know, there's always a shortage in the areas like special education, high school math, high school science. But now we're seeing shortages in the number of elementary school teachers, the pool of elementary school teachers, which is unusual. I think that's really what's changed for us.
And the retirement issue. I mean, that's what I keep hearing more and more, that you've had so many teachers just file for retirement because they just, it's just been too much over the last 2 years. Are you seeing a lot of that, Tricia?
Well, not as much. Our lawmakers did something last spring where they decided to pay more experienced teachers more money. Mm-hmm. And instead of getting a salary raise every 3 years, they get one every year. And it was a substantial amount. I mean, some teachers at the top end of experience got as much as a 21% raise this year. So I think that changed a lot of folks' minds about retiring.
And that will have an impact there. Brian Lopez, tell me the story in Texas.
So very similar, I think, to Alabama. Retaining teachers is starting to be hard. The attrition rate is shot up from when the pandemic first started. The amount of teachers that are retiring is also up. So those are the two main factors that Texas is seeing as to why, you know, teachers are leaving. And behind that, a lot of it is, you know, because of the pandemic, because of a lot of the attacks on books and critical race theory, right? Here, a lot of them have called that the last straw.
And Brian, there's been a lot of stories about a couple of districts in rural Texas thinking about 4-day weeks. How likely is that to spread?
Right now, it's very unlikely in your big, you know, urban cities. Mm-hmm. Rural districts usually have a little bit of more flexibility in terms of, you know, transportation, in terms of the community there. You know, I was talking to some school districts and they were telling me, you know, if they can't come on Friday, but, you know, they can go down and work with their mom or dad, or they can go spend the day with their aunts and uncles. So it's just a different kind of world they're living in compared to, you know, your Dallas, for example.
And Brian, what about in those urban areas? Are they seeing an increase in kids in affluent areas getting pulled out of public schools and going to the privates?
I can't speak too much a little bit about that right now. That's something that, you know, we're watching with interest, that we want to look at to see what's going to happen. You know, we do know that enrollment rates in your districts here in Texas, not even the small and the big ones, have been declining. And so, you know, it's up to us to figure out where those kids are going. And, you know, I want to touch on a little bit about the urban, more, you know, richer, affluent districts. You know,
right.
Their response to this is heavy pay raises, which, you know, your rural school districts just don't have the money to do. So they have to do, you know, well, we got 4 days here. You know, you get that extra day for your weekend.
Interesting. Tricia Crane, are you seeing, you know, any of this sort of an increase in homeschooling or things like, or private schooling, as parents sort of start to get nervous about the public school system?
We have seen that. And the pandemic, I think, really stepped it up. A lot of our schools were closed when they went back to school in 2020, and the parents began. We saw an increase in homeschooling, and we saw a decrease in enrollment last year, but it was, 2020. And then in 2021, we really kind of rebounded. So it seemed like if kids were pulled out, then they were put back in. So anxiously awaiting this year's enrollment numbers. I think we'll get them probably in November, and we'll have a better feel about that.
And Brian, we heard Tricia was saying in Alabama, they went hard at raising teacher salaries. Is the Texas legislature, is anybody talking about in there that, I mean, educate, one of the things in the Bush era when he was governor, it was one of those things that seemed to be bipartisan love for throwing money at the public school system down there. I imagine that attitude isn't the same these days.
So in Texas, actually, in 2019, I think it's similar to Alabama as well. They passed redid the school finances, and they gave teachers pay raises. And one of them is called the teacher incentive allotment. So you're really high performing, you know, master teachers are getting, you know, can make three-figure salaries in Texas. the problem is, you know, when you're talking to, you know, the people that represent teachers, you know, that your lobbyists that are representing public education and schools, you know, this isn't really a big, you know, spread out thing where a lot of teachers are making this money. So there's, you know, talks in this upcoming legislature that they're going to, you know, figure out how to, you know, tweak this thing. If it can be tweaked, how do you get more money to teachers? Because of course, you know, that's one of the first things people will say, right? Like, get teachers more money and they'll stay in the profession.
Right. And Trisha, are we seeing this teacher shortage create larger class sizes? What are the other ways that I think parents have to expect that they may feel this impact?
Well, that's one thing, larger class sizes, but also things like a shortage of bus drivers. I just saw a notice that a school district put out that said, I'm sorry, you know, we're really short on bus drivers, so expect late pickup and drop off tomorrow. So it's really all throughout the schools. Mm-hmm. But again, it's the same as Brian was saying, you know, the rural schools have a different type of challenge than the urban schools.
But each one of them have separate challenges, and at some point, parents aren't going to care about the differences. They just want some action. Anyway, Trisha Powell-Kane in Alabama, Brian Lopez in Texas, thank you both for sharing your reporting experiences with us. And thank you all for being with us this hour. I'll be back tomorrow with more Meet the Press Now. NBC News Now coverage continues with Hallie Jackson right now.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.